All right. Well, thank you, John. And it is indeed a privilege, actually, to be asked to speak at such an august event. And I mean that. It's been an interesting ride for Cochlear. So what I'd like to start with is to pay my rent, I suppose. I better tell you a little bit about Cochlear and what we do, partly to pay the rent and partly because it's cool. I've got flashing lights coming up later and all that kind of stuff. So most people usually enjoy that. I'll tell you a little bit about Cochlear. Magic. Many of you will have heard of us, hopefully. Here's a few facts and figures, just to let you know what's going on with the company. I've been with Cochlear now for 16 years, and it's been a really interesting journey. I arrived at the end of the cottage era when we were about 150 people, I think, back in 92. We've grown about 15 to 20% per annum, and that's meant that I've seen, in those 16 years, the company change its nature a number of times. So we're a medium to large-sized Australian company now, almost exclusively exporting our product. People lose their hearing around the world in more or less the same rate, whichever country you go to. Australia has about 3% of the OECD population, and therefore about 3% of our product go to Australians. So we're very much export dominated. We are headquartered here. This gives us some pluses and some minuses. A market leader with 60 or 70% of the market share. And we passed our 100,000th implant last year. So it may not sound like a large number. We're not traditionally think of ourselves as volume manufacturers, but these systems are not cheap. They retail for around about the $25,000 mark. And so that gives us an annual turnover now of about over half $1 billion at the moment. So we're becoming a sizable company. Just to briefly tell you what a cochlear implant is, we're pretty much a one product company. This is what we make. It's a system that currently is in two bits, a part that's worn behind the ear, like this, and then the part that's implanted surgically in a procedure that is almost day surgery now, but it's usually an overnight stay in hospital, but there are places starting to do this as day surgery. So it's become a lot simpler than the early days. An electrode array here is passed into the organ. This is the cochlea, and this is the thing that in a normal hearing person turns sound that comes in here into electrical impulses in nerves that go off to the brain. So that's what the product is, and it's aimed largely at people who have no alternative. So a hearing aid will amplify sound. It'll make the air vibrations bigger, but if you don't have the little hair cells or cilia in the cochlea here that do the transducing from vibration into neural impulses, then you can make the vibrations as big as you like if those transducers are missing, which is what normally happens in about 80% of people who are profoundly deaf. Then you'll get nothing. So most people that are profoundly deaf have very little option. The really interesting thing is that in recent years, it's becoming evident that cochlear implants, we've advanced to the point where we're better than hearing aids for the next category, which is a severe hearing impaired. And so we're starting to move up that. It's an exponential curve of people who have lost their hearing. So a smaller number are profound. Next, a larger number are severe, and so forth up the chain. So our market is still very large and still well underpenetrated. I am aware I'm running a bit short on time, and I'm supposed to talk about innovation, but this is cool. Let's try this demo. So Tom and I have got a little deal going here. He's very kindly hooked it up so that as I speak into this speaker, it runs a little program running on my laptop over there. So I'll just we'll do a little bit of speech 101, I guess. I'll make a couple of different sounds, and you can see why the cochlear implant works or how it works. This is a demonstration of the speech signal. This is actually a frequency along here, so high frequencies, shh, up the top, low frequencies, down the bottom. And you can see that's mapped directly onto these 22 electrodes that we stimulate in the cochlea. Shh, and that's how we hear. So the way, for example, we would distinguish an R from an OO, two vowel sounds, if I make an R, and now I change it to an OO, OO, ah, see it shifting around? That's how you and I a hearing, and that's how a cochlear implant recipient hears, because they get the nerves in this part of the cochlear are in the low frequency range, and in this part of the cochlear are the shh high frequency range. Same with a shh, so forth. And that's how we hear. And you can see that speech is actually quite a redundant mechanism. The bit rate, if you like, engineers like to talk about how many bits it takes to encode a signal, is actually quite low. And so it's actually a miracle of our brains rather than our ears, able to reinterpret 22 electrodes into what would normally be about 20,000 nerve cells. But you'll see the actual information content in speech is still preserved, even with 22 electrodes. So that's why I am standing here today employed by Cochlear, because our brains are smart and able to do the 20 to 20,000 translation for us. Can we go to the next one? Thanks, Tom. Fantastic. All right, well, I was asked to come and talk about innovation and the management of innovation, I suppose, so I probably should do a little bit about that. This is a model. Churchill said, I think Churchill said, plans are nothing, planning is everything. So I don't hold this up as the definitive model of innovation that we should all write down and go and pursue in Australia. Far from it. But what I would say is that the exercise of getting to this point is quite a useful one for our organisation to do. But there are some parallels that are actually quite interesting on the national agenda as well. And many of the models, if you look of innovation, break it up into essentially three main elements. And I just hearing some of the, I think it was Terry Cutler this morning, I just wanted to, I'll tell you how we got to this point, and then I'll maybe project it up onto the national level as well, just to hopefully provoke a bit of thought. We think that there are actually three major elements in innovation, each of which that requires different skills and I guess different people ultimately with different skills to get it right. And the interesting thing about innovation, I think, is it's a bit like golf. Every bit of your game has to be right in order to get a low score. So if you're driving well but the putting's awful, you'll still score, you know, like I do, 120 or whatever. So very quickly going through these three elements. Innovation, absolutely critical to innovate, that you understand the people that you're trying to innovate for. And it can be whoever you like. It can be whatever group you happen to stumble across. But you need to understand them. So it's absolutely critical to be in touch with these people. Little startups normally don't have this problem. They're right there at the coalface. In the early days of Cochlear, for example, they were physically there. They had the people in the clinic, and they were talking to their patients. Our engineers in Cochlear don't do that anymore. Very important to keep up that link. At the same time, our view of innovation is that it's a meeting, and interestingly, a meeting in an individual's mind. Innovation is definitely a team sport. But individuals have ideas. So you have to expose. So, for example, if you have a marketing department at one end of the corridor and an engineering department at the other, you may have the best marketers in the world who fully understand the customers they're trying to innovate for. You may have engineers that fully understand the technologies that can be applied to innovate. If those two groups never meet, then an individual person, be it an engineer or a marketer, we'll never have an idea that solves the problem. Yeah? An interesting insight. So you have to have people who understand both the customers you're trying to solve problems for and the technologies which can be applied to those problems. You have to have the inspire bit. You have to have a bit of a sense of fun, a bit of a sense of creativity in your organization. A lot of corporates are very good at driving things, getting things done. The last bit of the here, they're not always so good at what we call the inspire or the inspiration. I've got one or two examples in a second. I'll keep it brief. But if I go to a conservatorium of music in Sydney, for example, and Melbourne I know is a much more rarefied and artistic town, so I'm sure it's far better here. But if you go to the Con, you'll see musicians wandering around humming a tune. You'll hear music coming out of every practice room. Yeah. This is how your organisation needs to be to get this right. You've got to have people playing tricks on the CEO. Yeah, it's got to be a fun place to work. If it's not, then this gap will be missing, and this will be the putting part of your game of golf or whatever it is. And you may implement great ideas, you may understand your customers and your technologies, but you won't be generating the real creative stuff that Australians are famous for. And then the implementation side, of course, Toyota here, you know, is famous for this system, great at taking an idea and turning it into a product. And arguably, Australia, we've heard this morning, Australia doesn't necessarily do well in that area nationally. But a thought occurred to me earlier as I was listening to a previous talk. But one industry, and what Cochlear and many industries do quite well, is if you look on a team level, yeah, we do teams for everything, cross-functional teams for just about everything these days, and with good reason, because no one person can understand the complexities of Cochlear's innovation system, let alone the national innovation system. Industry has over the years developed some quite good techniques for getting people to work together well on a team. So, for example, I've run a few project teams in my time. And as a good project manager, you know, you'll put in a marketer, you'll have maybe a mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer, depending on the product you're developing. But as a project manager, you don't try and turn an electrical engineer into a mechanical engineer or try and make a marketer into an electrical engineer. That would be crazy. What you do is you get the people on the team to respect each other. You get them to understand the issues that the electrical engineer has and the mechanical engineer has and the marketer has. Respect those issues and say, right, guys, we have a product to get out here. This is our ultimate game. All right. Now, arguably, if you project that to the national level, I'm not so sure that's happening so well at the national level. If you think of this area here, the creative guys, as our universities and research organisations, you think of the implement side as our industry. I'm not sure, and I've sat on both sides of the camp. I've been an academic and an industry researcher. I'm not so sure that these two groups respect each other very well. And I'm not even sure that we have a very good group like this in Australia. When I go as someone in industry trying to get information on what are the processes and what are the processes I can use to understand my stakeholders better, it's pretty slim pickings in this country. The US does it far better than we do. There's two companies I know about, for example, one called ACID, a spin-off of a CRC based up in Queensland, and a group down here in Melbourne called Different. They're the only two that I can actually use and apply to my business. So I think there's a bit of a gap here as well. But most importantly, as a project manager, I want these guys to work together, not try and be each other, not necessarily to want to turn academics into implementers, but to have them respect each other and talk to each other. So that's my bit of insight for the morning. Very quickly, then, I've probably blown most of my time already. But anyway, I'll just give you one quick example of some of the things that we've done in Cochlear in each of those three areas. So what do you do to involve people? Well, there are some techniques. I actually had to go to the US. I was lucky enough to find a fellow who used to be the new product director for Bose, the lifestyle people. It's about a $5 billion US company. They developed some techniques. He happened to be in Melbourne running a startup company which didn't succeed, but he had some really interesting ideas. And this was a result of one customer survey that we did. This fellow here is a sushi chef. We were producing a product. We'd had some problems in the Asian market. It's very hot, sticky. A lot of Asia is hot and sticky, of course. That doesn't actually show up too well on this slide. But anyway, one of the things that the guys came back with was a real need to make this thing waterproof. And our current product that we've released, again, is world-beating, but one of its features is it's waterproof. And the guys went to Asia and saw people struggling. They saw someone drying out their speech processor. This fellow had to give a talk. It was a Cochlear recipient. We'd lined him up to give a speech. And his speech processor went off the air. It was a hot, steamy night in Asia. And they saw this guy holding his speech processor over an air conditioner because the dry air was dehumidified and would dry it out. And he did eventually get it working. But they saw this poor guy panicking. You know, he had to give a talk. He wouldn't be able to listen to questions and so forth. And then they thought, right, you know, this is not on. And we had previously been adopting hearing aid technologies and transposing into our product, not good enough. You know, we produce a premium product. Anyway, I won't dwell too much longer on this, but basically there are systems and methods to allow you to get out there and understand your customers. This was a result of a lot of work summarized in one page, but it gave the team, you know, people come along and say, what have you guys been doing for the last few weeks, you know, on this project team? You're supposed to be producing a product. We haven't seen you. Well, then they whipped this out and said, this is what we've been doing. We understand the market we're trying to serve now. Now, I'll see if Tom can, the master of technology over there, can give us a bit of a video just to demonstrate the Inspire part of what's going on. I set up it's probably best if I play. All right, so this is something we do now. We try and do it a couple of times a year if we can. Cochlear Innovation Challenge.
Welcome.
How do you get people creative?
To MI6 training headquarters. Troubles afoot. Field spies have invaded the Adelaide Oval, and the future of the world is at stake.
I'm not such a great actor, so we might fast forward it now if we can, Tom.
0.00.
All right, so we want to have a bit of fun. We want a culture at Cochlear where it's okay to have a bit of fun occasionally, take a Friday afternoon off and have a few games. All right? And actually, there's a fair bit of purpose to it. But I'm not allowed to say, even in Cochlear, it's like, you know, we can just play games. I have to say, oh, yeah, but there's a serious purpose. Well, we're not quite there yet. But we can at least have a bit of fun sometimes. Okay. I'll just show you one more. See how it goes. Alright, so just an example of some things that can be done in an organisation to have a bit of fun. A couple of times a year we get together, and one of the rules I have about this is your teams can't all be from one department. You have to search around a bit. Stuff like that, right? Because we're trying to... Communication is a contact sport. Innovation is a contact sport. We're trying to get people talking to each other. And finally, on the implementation side, program that we have running now in Cochlear called TechLite. We set up an ideas database, did all the usual sort of stuff you do when you're trying to be innovative, collect people's ideas, and then, of course, we've got 1,000 ideas in the database. What do we do with them? Well, you know, this is one thing we can do. Anyone in the company, basically, who has an idea can apply to the TechLite panel. It sits a couple of times a year. I'd like to do it a little more frequently, but anyway. You can get up to $50,000 and go and try your idea, basically. Very simple process. I hate paperwork. I really wanted to keep things simple. So you just come along and report, often verbally, back to the panel just to let us know how it's going after 6 months. What went wrong with this, actually, is that the most precious commodity in Cochlear is time, not cash at the moment. You know, we're a relatively cash-rich company. But a very time-poor company. So what we've realised we need to do for the next round, we've run 2 rounds of this now, and some of them have been successful, some haven't. We need to actually allocate people's time to do this project. They were trying to do it in the cracks. It didn't work, largely. So we thought we'd be able to swap money for time, and basically the entrepreneurs that came up with the ideas wanted to do it. So that was our mistake. Well, there were two types of people. Some of them wanted to do it. Some of them were happy to outsource it. So the ones that were happy to outsource, they paid a contractor to go and try out their idea, and they were successful generally. Successful in making the project happen, not necessarily in the technology. But the bright young things that wanted that had the idea wanted to do it themselves. They weren't successful. So that's a learning from that. So they're just examples of the sort of stuff we've tried to try and address those three areas. Now, I need to pay the rent again, sorry. Yes, this is another commercial commercial break. You know, one of the things we've heard about this morning is that we don't commercialize terribly well in this country. And I would suggest that organizations like Cochlear that have made it have both a responsibility and a privilege and a right and a responsibility to help build an innovative Australia, if you like. One of the things I'm very strong on is talent from overseas. I think we can be world-beating in this country. We have certain strengths, but we need to catch up with the rest of the world in certain areas of innovation first. So I try and sponsor people. I'll show you that in a second. But these are the sort of things that companies like Cochlear tend to do. We invest about 12% of our turnover back into innovation. We actually train a lot of people. I know our schools and universities are obviously essential in the training area, but actually people that come to Cochlear, young, talented staff that come to Cochlear, whether they know it or not, are actually getting trained in how to innovate. At least I hope they are, because we're trying to be an innovative organisation, and they're learning that. They'll go elsewhere, of course, and hopefully pass it on to other organisations. So I won't dwell too long on that, but another part of the commercial break. So just to reinforce that, there's a couple of conferences that we've tried to get involved with on innovation. I happen to like these two. There are a few in Australia, but these happen to suit Cochlear's needs well. But these are the people we've brought in into the country, national people what I consider to be world-leading thinkers, I guess, in their own areas. I love this guy. I used to pay for him all by myself until, I'm pleased to say, Hargreaves, which is a group that Cochlear belongs to, an innovation organisation that Cochlear belongs to, on his third visit, they're going to sponsor him later this year. He's into TRIZ, the systematic problem-solving methodology. But a whole bunch of people, SIT is an alternative to TRIZ, I suppose. A bunch of people that I've tried to sponsor through that. So I think that's a very important role that the companies like Cochlear have. One little thing that I will mention is the current state of affairs in terms of government support, at least that Cochlear receives, is very much centred around technical research and what they call it systematic investigation and experimentation. My own feeling is, and Cochlear's feeling is, that it needs to be a lot broader. We get virtually no support at all for any IP, and I think that's generally true of most Australian companies, and generally I think it's true in Australia. We don't handle our IP terribly well. It tends to disappear overseas. So I won't dwell too long on this, but also we've heard a bit about this earlier today. There are other types of innovation other than just purely what Cochlear is good at, just turning technology into products, and I think probably Cochlear needs to learn that lesson as well. Cochlear can market itself better, can get different business models and different processes to build on its technological advantage. And down the other end, we don't really reward companies that are prepared to take risks and prepared to take on creative talent as opposed to, I suppose companies don't look for non-creative talent, but, we don't, there's nowhere do we look at our people skills and say, right, the government will never say, we'll give you a grant if you employ a creative person in this area or whatever. I'll finish on this. I just want to plug quickly. We've heard the tyranny of distance and so forth. That's all true. There are advantages that Australian organisations have, and here's one that Cochlear's exploited particularly well, I think. I'm sorry about the graph. It's maybe not all that clear, but the message I'm trying to get across here is that we operate in the whole of the world. The three main regions that we divide the world up into are the US, Europe, and the rest of the world. This is Cochlear's market share, so we're market leaders in every one of those areas. But if you go to the US, for example, we have a US competitor that does quite well in the US, doesn't beat us, but does quite well, but pretty poorly in the rest of the world. And if you go to Europe, we have a strong European competitor who also does poorly in the rest of the world. And if you go to the rest of the world, we basically beat a lot of them. All right? And that's no coincidence. Australian companies and organisations are very good at doing that. All right? We have a very multicultural society here, and because of that tyranny of distance, we have to know how to operate in other markets. But you look at our competitors, they don't. US companies in particular aren't very good at operating outside the US and vice versa. So huge strength that Australia needs to play to, I think. And I know I'm probably over time, so I won't dwell on this, but if you're interested, I sat down on a plane one time and wrote down the 10 things that I'd learned as an innovation manager over the last couple of years having been doing this job. And there they are, so I won't go into any of these individually, but I'm sure you can get a copy of the slides if you're interested, or come see me and I'll email you a copy. Better hang up there because I'm sure I'm over time already. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. And you're right on the dot in terms of time, so well done. That's tremendous. Now I ask Richard to come to the podium to give his insights.
Thanks, John. Pleasure to be here today. It's always a good opportunity to have a chance to talk about the things we do at Monash, aside from start companies like Cochlear. Today I'll be talking about team working, which, as you've heard, is one of the things I'm interested in. As we just heard from Paul, it's the major way in which companies try and mobilise human capital, mobilise knowledge in order to achieve innovation and improvement. One of my interests in this is to look at some of the differences between innovation and improvement, because I think innovation has some different requirements from normal business activities, including improvement activities. And it has these requirements because often the goals and objectives of innovation are rather ambiguous. If we want to make some improvement, we often have a very clear, well-defined goal. We need to improve by this much to catch up with world's best practice, for example. We have specific areas that we're looking at. When we're looking at larger scale innovations, it's often not clear where they'll lead. So outcomes are often uncertain when we're talking about innovation, and often the process for doing it is rather indeterminate. Paul's just told us he's got ways of managing projects, he's got ways of trying to inspire people, but no one can give you a recipe for how to actually get an innovation done. Teamwork, as we've heard, is an important way of doing these things, because teaming up is one way of promoting cross-functional activity. So we involve all the stakeholders, that's very important. It's one way of promoting interdisciplinary activity, and many innovations arise from a convergence of knowledge. Just this semester, some of my students were looking at the birth of the mobile phone, for example. And these are undergraduates I'm talking about now. They thought it was invented sometime around 1995 when they first bought one, and were astonished to find out that Motorola had been experimenting with this since the 1970s. And what Motorola did was to take their existing knowledge of radio communication systems and then marry that up with knowledge of telephone communication systems. And it took a long while to bring these two domains of knowledge together. Teamwork also promotes better communication within firms and without firms. And if you've got some effective teams, then you achieve better task performance. So we've been looking at what's the focus of innovation and improvement in Australian industries, and what kind of teamwork structures do they use? Because we're interested in the way in which firms create a model of productive organisation, one that marries up the way in which they do things with the human talent and the human capacities that they have. If we look here, we can see that the focus of innovation is often very industry specific. The construction industry, for example, is very distinctive. The main thing that they're focused on is occupational health and safety. Some of that's driven by government regulation. We've all seen discussions about work cover and creating a national system for occupational health and safety. They're also interested in continuous improvement. They're interested in adapting new technology to improving what they do. When we looked at manufacturing and financial services, we found there were some similarities there. They had a focus on product innovation. Here's two sectors that are more globally oriented, And they have realised that continuous improvement is not going to get them there anymore. They need to focus on innovation and continuous improvement and the use of new technologies. Finally, we looked at two professional services sector, legal services and health services. Here the focus was on continuous improvement and quality certification. So in some ways this sector, doing the sort of things that manufacturing and financial services and other sectors did in the late 80s, early 1990s, focusing on developing systems for managing quality and implementing systems of continuous improvement. So when we look across the sectors, we can see there's a strong focus on improvement activities. This is something that we started to do, as I said, in the late 80s, early 90s, and we've got good at it now. There's some evidence here, as you'll see, to support this contention. But it's still an important thing across all sectors, and keeping up with new technology, finding ways to adapt new technology, equally important across sectors. So that's the focus of what people are doing. We then looked at how they were attempting to do it. What kinds of team working did they use? Again, we found some similarities and differences across sectors. In construction, manufacturing and financial services, temporary project teams were the most widely used form of teamwork. Perhaps not surprising in construction because that's what they do. They move from project to project and so they use a lot of temporary forms of team working. But it's just as widely used in manufacturing and financial services. Professional services were a little bit different. They were focused more on permanent continuous improvement teams. So they had established a permanent system for making improvements, achieving quality certification. When we looked inside these teams, what we found was some broad similarities with the exception of health and legal services. So these temporary project teams often involve less than 10% of employees. They're very small. They usually have a very short lifespan, 3 to 6 months, with the exception of professional services. They have a senior report. And they have a mix of different types of employees in them. You can see in some sectors more management dominated, but in all sectors there's a mix of managers, professional skilled employees, technically skilled employees, and frontline operators. So when we look at this dominant form of team working in Australian firms, I think it supports this focus on continuous improvement and the adoption of new technology, that these temporary project teams are the most widely used. So this is evidence of an effective system of organisation for improvement activities. As I said, over the course of 20 years, I think we've learnt how to do it. We spent a lot of time initially looking at best practice, looking at the adoption of quality management tools and techniques, for example, that include these forms of team working. When we looked at the satisfaction of the respondents with their team working arrangements, we also found a few interesting things. Firstly, it tended to be larger firms that were more satisfied with their arrangements, possibly because in larger firms, they use more team working. Many of them have longer experience of doing it. And perhaps in some smaller and medium-sized firms, things are done more informally. We need to do some more case studies type research now to explore some of these ideas. The other thing we found, though, that's consistent with much of the discussion that we've heard this morning is that it's also those firms that are exporters that have operations outside of Australia, so they're globally focused, internationally focused. These are the firms that make the most use and have the greatest satisfaction with their use of team working. The number of projects underway was also important, and perhaps this is an effect of past success with using teams, that we've used them in the past and so we use more of them. As we learn how to do it, we're able to actually run more projects simultaneously. And there you can also see at the bottom that the main kind of team working that firms were satisfied with were these project teams, the temporary project teams and some permanent project teams. So as I say, we can see some evidence that over the course of 20 years, firms in these industries have developed an effective system of team organisation for improvement activities. But my question is this also a suitable form of team organisation for innovation activities? That maybe what we need to be thinking about now is how we adapt this system that we have to larger scale innovation rather than short-term continuous improvement activities. Because the emphasis on temporary teams, I think, has some potential pitfalls. Firstly, it may mean that we see innovation as a one-off event. We start to look at innovation the way we've looked at continuous improvement in the past. And what that may mean is that much of the project knowledge that's created in the course of innovation projects is not actually captured, because all we focus on is the start-up and wind-up of the project. And how we capture that knowledge, roll it over into other projects, find other things to do with it, is an important question. This has got more to do with just focusing on teams. We're now talking about the way in which teams are integrated within this system of productive organisation that firms have. So we run the risk that the learning that's developed in projects won't be embedded in new projects, and importantly, that skill development won't be continuous. Yeah. Discontinuous skill development means that people lose skills. We know that skills and skill development is something that needs to be maintained through practice. Not much point giving training, not much point involving people in project activities if they don't then continue on using the skills and using the knowledge that they've developed. This emphasis on temporary teams, as I said, may also mean that innovation comes to be seen as just another kind of improvement activity. So we might stretch the boundaries a little bit of what we do, but it's not going to lead us down the path of real innovation in process, innovation in the sense of new products, innovation in the sense of developing new business models. So it may mean that innovation comes to be seen as simply adding new features to existing products, tweaking what we already have, extending the life of what we already have. And that's got a short-term benefit, but it doesn't lead to long-term sustainability. Innovation may also come to be seen as something that's expected to produce short-term results. You've seen that most of these teams have a short lifespan, 3 to 6 months. It's often not possible to produce an innovation within that time, and we know that early closure of innovation projects can often stifle innovation, that people rush to a configuration of technology and product too soon, and more time spent exploring, trying, learning through trial and error may in fact lead to a more significant innovation. So I think there's some need for some Australian examples of good practice here. We've seen, as I said, the way in which industries have taken up the idea of using teams to make improvements. Now we have to convince them of the need to take up forms of team working to make innovations as well. And as I keep saying, maybe these forms of team working need to be a little bit different to the ones that we've used to do improvement activities. And there's a need to extend our understanding of team organisation. At the moment, most of the research is focused on individual teams. We know a lot about what makes them effective, how to deal with poor performance in teams, what are some of the key issues in establishing a team, getting it to be effective quickly, how do we deal with underperformance. All of that we know about within individual teams, but what we know less about, as I said, is how those teams are connected to the broader organisation, to the management systems, to the organisational structures. Some of the ways in which it's done in other countries, I'm not aware of any examples of them being used here. I'm sure they exist, but no one's ever gone out, found them, written them up and put them into the literature. Some firms find ways to have a permanent organisation for project teams. Informally, I'm aware of a couple of companies in Melbourne that have evolved this over a period of time. How well aware they are of what they've actually done, I'm not entirely sure. What I'm talking about here is firms that actually have a distinct part of their business as project teams. And so they have internal mechanisms for setting up those teams, managing the process through stage gates, because it's not possible to manage the development of things, but it's possible to evaluate the outcomes of what teams produce. Another technique that's widely used is to have multiple competing project teams. And again, we evaluate the results of what those teams produce and maybe wind some of them up early and let others continue on that seem to have good ideas developing. And we also don't have much of an idea about the way in which we can use these forms of organisation for engaging business partners. And they're very important when it comes to innovation because they often have specialised knowledge that we need to bring in. They often have specialised skills that we need to bring in. How do we learn to work together effectively with other firms, especially firms with highly specialised skills and knowledge? So let me finish off by talking about what we need to do at Monash. If we look at the state of knowledge about team working, many of the early studies of teamwork that were carried out in British coal mines after the Second World War, in Swedish car factories, emphasised the relationship between the design of work, the overall business process and performance. And those of you who are familiar with that literature will know it led to the creation of the concept of the autonomous work team. Happily, one of the main figures in the creation of this idea was an Australian, Fred Emery. He did much of the early work that created the ideas that we now use about team working. Contemporary research, however, as I said, has gone back to looking just within individual teams, the human dynamics of what makes them work. When you want to try and understand from a more systemic point of view how they're used, the literature is very thin. It tells us a great variety of teamwork practices are used. And I think many academics got to that point and said, great, we don't understand how or why this variety exists, but we've found a variety of stuff that's good. And much of the literature also says there's now a greater focus on the performance outcomes of team working. The original concept of autonomous team was as much about employee outcomes in terms of job satisfaction. Now the focus has got to be on what are the performance outcomes in terms of innovation and improvement. Beyond that, as I said, we can find a few isolated case examples of what individual firms are doing, but unfortunately I'm not able to tell you much more about how you might effectively use team working. So that's our challenge, to understand the ways in which firms develop distinctive models of productive organisation, and these entail the use of distinctive ensembles of teamwork practices. So the set of practices you find in one firm, different to what you find in another firm. And we need to start to understand how these ensembles of teamwork practices might be driven by different managerial goals and objectives. Some firms might focus on improvement, others might focus on innovation. Different areas of innovation might be the focus. And we need to understand how these ensembles of teamwork practices used a different mix of task-focused teams, like our project teams, along with product and process-focused teams. So some knowledge that we can share with you about the current state of practice and some knowledge that we need to keep working on to develop to understand where we can go to in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard, for that thought-provoking commentary. Just if I could ask people to note down their questions so they don't forget them when we come to the panel, because I think both our speakers have raised a number of issues that could be further explored, but so please don't forget those issues when we come to the opportunity to ask questions at the conclusion of the panel. I'd now like to ask our next speaker, Tim Petlick, to come to the stage and give his perception of innovation.
Thanks, John. Good morning, everyone. Before John introduced me, he came up to me and asked me how he should introduce me, because I gave a similar talk at CEDA in Sydney at the beginning of April, and then I was the managing director of What If Innovation Proprietary Limited, and now I'm no longer the managing director of What If Innovation Proprietary Limited, and that was the question that John was asking me. And I think the reason that I'm no longer the managing director of What If Innovation is interesting about innovation in this country in many respects. And for those who don't know What If is the largest independent innovation company in the world. It's based in the UK, but offices in other countries of the world, and had had an Australian office for 6.5 years. And unfortunately, for some period of time, that Australian office had been floundering a little bit. And the things that What If does is that they help businesses innovate in two ways, largely. They do innovation projects, undertake innovation projects for businesses, and they train businesses in particularly creative thought, some of the sorts of things that Paul Carter was showing us in terms of the fun that Cochlear was having. And what If found was that Australia was not a very fertile marketplace for its offering, certainly not as fertile as other marketplaces in the world. And so I just want to spend a little bit of time looking at potentially some of the lessons that might have come out of that experience. What If Innovation is closed in Australia now? And since I'm the master of the sweeping generalisation, I might adopt some sweeping generalisations just to provoke, if I can this morning, in terms of those reasons. I mean, first of all, it was the global board of What If decided to close the office here in Australia. And I think one of the reasons for that is what we saw on Terry Cutler's NASA chart, the hotspots, the light hotspots. And the fact is that there's an awful lot happening in countries like China and India, but even in the US today, and What If's innovation practices, businesses in those countries are absolutely booming. And in fact, they can't keep up with the demand in those countries. Whereas the need to sell innovation in this country is actually quite difficult on a fee-for-service basis. And for me, my perspective, I guess, as an entrepreneur, an individual who, at least for the last decade or so, has been involved in startups, not just here in Australia, but overseas as well, I haven't spent much time with big business in the last decade or so. And so the 6 months that I was afforded the opportunity as the head of What If to spend some time with big business, I had my eyes opened. I was a little bit shocked, in fact, by some of what I saw. So in no particular order, these are some of the things that I saw. I saw that there was a complacency. I would go and talk to people in some large businesses, some very senior managers, and I had always assumed that they didn't know how to innovate, that what they were searching was an opportunity to understand how to innovate. In fact, what I found was that they don't really need to. They don't really want to, because they're quite complacent with things the way they are. In fact, I got a lot of let's not rock the boat messages, particularly whilst we're riding off the back of the natural resources boom. I saw that there's an awful lot of activity. And I can't count the number of times I was invited back for another meeting. And I see that activity as an opportunity for people in businesses to be seen to be doing something rather than actually doing anything. And in some cases, you know, some of the clients or potential clients we were talking about, we'd be talking to for months and months and months. And every single meeting we'd come away with would be a very positive one. And they were keen to move forward, but it would take another 3 months before the next meeting to talk about the following meeting that we were about to have. There's an enormous amount of risk aversion. And I think one of the fundamental issues in relation to innovation, and I'm going to talk a little bit more in a moment about entrepreneurialism, one of the fundamental issues is that innovation is risky because by its very nature it's going forward, it's doing things sometimes that haven't been done before, and when things haven't been done before, there is inherent risk. And organisations, particularly large organisations, are very risk averse. And so one of the questions that I have, and one of the questions I'll pose in fact to you later in my talk this morning, is whether or not big business is the place that disruptive innovation can ever really take place in this country. I saw a lot of businesses trapped in conventional thinking, received wisdom. You know, this is the way that it's always been done in this industry. This is the way we always do it. This is the way we have to do it. Our industry is different from other industries. And it's an enormously dangerous trap, this notion of conventional thinking rather than lateral thinking or what potentially I'd call constructive thinking. And I know organisations are rule-bound. They have to be, because the more and more people you get in organisations, the more difficult it becomes to manage and deploy that human resource. And so rules become an easy way of managing organisations, but rules are often misplaced. And in fact, I wasn't intending to, but I will tell you my red circle story because I always find it quite amusing. It's a true story. It occurred in the UK after World War II. It was an RAF airbase that was about to undertake an inspection and a parade. There was some bigwig, an air commodore or someone flying in to inspect the base. And over the other side of the parade ground, there was a shed. And there was a guy, an airman, who was renewing the paint on the shed. And because we're in post-war euphoria, rather than gunmetal grey or drab olive or something, he was painting it vivid red. Well, he realised he was running out of time and the parade was about to take place, so he hurriedly finished painting the shed, and in his haste to go and get ready, he was running across the parade ground and he tripped and he fell and he spilled the red paint on the parade ground. He didn't want to let the regiment down, didn't want to let the side down, and so he realised he didn't have time to clean up the paint spill. But he must have been a smart airman, perhaps an amateur psychologist, and so he thought, you know, people don't necessarily recognise regular shapes. So rather than try and clean up the paint spill, he painted it into a circle, a red circle on the parade ground. He rushed off, got ready. The parade went off without a hitch. Nobody noticed or commented on the sticky red, newly painted circle on the parade ground. For the next 30 years on that airbase, religiously every 6 months, an RAF maintenance crew renewed the red paint on the circle. Until someone had been on the base for 5 years said, you know, I've been here 5 years, I've never seen anything happen with that red circle except someone paints it. And he dug back through the regimental records, and the actual story of the red circle was documented in the regimental records. But it had translated into a work order for the maintenance team. You know, red circle equals we must maintain. Now, there was a very good reason for that red circle to be there in 1947 or 48 when the paint spill took place. But there was no longer a reason for that red circle to be there 30 years later. And organisations tend to work that way. You know, the safety and security and lack of risk in rules. And innovation is the antithesis of rule-bound conventional thinking. But organisations necessarily take safety in that conventional thinking. I think in Australia, my experience this 6 or 7 months at What If was that there's a lot of penny-pinching going on. And in part, that's the fault of the industry. And certainly What If had quite a lot to blame itself for in terms of doing that, and that's about not necessarily positioning innovation on an outcome basis rather than an input basis. And so organisations tend to look at the cost of innovation rather than the potential outcome from innovation, and I'm going to talk more about that in a second as well. And the other thing I guess I observed, and these are just my observations, is that there's an enormous amount of waiting for something to happen, or rather waiting for someone else to do something. I guess it's linked to the let's have another meeting syndrome. But what I mean by that is there's a lot of, well, let's wait for Terry Cutler, for example, to come out with his report. Let's wait for the government to tell us what we should be doing. Let's wait for head office in the US to give us a steer or a direction. There's a let's wait game that is played quite frequently. And that let's wait is a tremendous barrier to innovation, in my view. So with those provocative early opening remarks, that's why What If is no longer with us. Much greater opportunity in more fertile marketplaces around the globe. It was a very interesting learning experience for me in the 7 months that I was there. And I guess renewed for me my desire to go out and innovate through example, and that means entrepreneurship. So I was, however, not asked to talk about the experience of What If Innovation in Australia. I was asked to talk about measuring and defining innovation. And so let's talk about innovation. Why is it important? Well, we all know that innovation fuels economic growth. And I think in Australia in particular, that economic growth through innovation is dreadfully important at this time, because we've sort of gone from riding off the sheep's back to riding off the iron ore's back, off the natural resources boom. But, you know, we need to build something sustainable in terms of being a clever country, and I don't really see that happening. That's the sort of economic growth we need. I picked this quote just because I found it funny, and the bit that I liked was, add as many mail coaches as you please, you'll never get a railroad by doing so. That's the difference between working harder and working smarter, really. Innovation is about building a railroad rather than focusing on more mail coaches. And I think it was Einstein, wasn't it, who defined stupidity as, you know, doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different result. And innovation is the antithesis of that. It's about doing things differently, in a different way, to achieve a bigger result. And so when I started thinking about how I define innovation personally, and what innovation meant to me, I started from a point of view of, well, what are some of the innovation myths that perhaps need to be exposed in terms of defining or measuring innovation? And I see an enormous amount of focus on the fact that innovation is synonymous with scientific research, or that it's about research and development, or in fact inventions. And more frequently, what I hear all the time is innovation is about ideas. Now, of course, all of those things are important to innovation, but they are not in and of themselves definitions of innovation. And I want to start with that notion of ideas, first of all. We've heard it already this morning, but I want to reinforce it. Ideas alone have no monetary value. If I had a dollar, even if I had 50 cents, for every person in the last decade who's come up to me and said, I've got this fantastic idea, I would be a very rich man. And the world is brim full of ideas. And in fact, in the period of time that I was with What If, I had many companies say, you know what, we're throwing out ideas that, like, you wouldn't believe. And the fact of the matter is that ideas have no value unless they're converted into something. And so conversion of ideas into, in this case, because my interest is in building businesses, I guess, into something commercial is critically important. So how would I define innovation if I was asked to do so? Well, I've pinched bits of this definition from a whole variety of different sources, but I've sought to focus on inputs and outputs rather than just inputs alone. So innovation is fresh thinking or a different approach to the marketplace. For me, the marketplace is important because I operate in a commercial world, which creates value. It's about that value creation for a company and its customers, or for society at large, because I don't think we should ignore broader not-for-profit innovation either. And how is that done through? Well, so of course it's done through ideas, through design, through invention, through development and implementation of new products and services, and through different business processes and different business models. But the intention of innovation is to create output, is to create value. It's not about having more ideas or focusing on the inputs to the equation. And similarly to Paul Carter, and I, this is the What If Innovation model, actually, ideas alone are not sufficient. Effective innovation has to start with insight, and that is the customer. It starts with the customer. And leads from that into ideas, and then from that into impact or implementation or execution. And when you get all three of those things right, you get effective innovation. And what so frequently happens is that individuals or businesses, organisations focus on one element of those three things alone. So ideas are often orphans, and that's the reason they have no monetary value. They need to be linked to genuine consumer insight. And genuine consumer insight, by the way, is often not found by quantitative market research, which is one of the tools that big businesses often hide behind. As Paul told us, you know, when Cochlear started, it was because the guys, the founders, were involved with patients on a daily basis. So getting effective insight is very easy when you put yourself in the shoes of your customers or where you spend time with your customers, whoever they may be. It's interesting, I've pulled this out of an STW survey, I think, that was taken middle of last year. It was asking Australians to define what they thought of great companies or what were the most important elements of great companies. And these were the top five elements that people in Australia thought great companies should be about. They needed to be determined, and beyond that, they needed to be inventive, innovative, fresh thinking and fresh ideas. So four of those top five measures are about innovation. And I would argue, by the way, that one of the reasons that it's top of mind for customers in this marketplace is because we so rarely see it from the businesses that supply customers in this marketplace. And so there's a crying need for it. You know, customers all across this country are saying, for heaven's sake, give us something different. Don't dish up more of the same. So it does, I think, measuring innovation does extend beyond inputs, because without output measures, you don't get any of that fresh thinking, that inventive practice delivered to customers. So tracking and measuring inputs like the number of new patents registered a year or R&D spending, whether it's at a country level or whether it's at a corporate level, are obviously important, but they are part of the picture and part of the picture alone, and often obscure the real measure of innovation. I don't think when we're talking about measuring innovation that we can ignore what I've called here the third dimension, which is a bit ephemeral, I guess, this notion of innovation energy or the environment. We all need energy to thrive. The reason that Paul showed up pictures of that fun activity, that inspire activity, is that it encourages creativity. If you work in a grey for micro office, you have grey for micro ideas. You need energy, the right sort of creative energy, to think differently. And most businesses don't focus on that energy. And as a country, we probably need to focus on that energy as well. How do we create the energy that allows us to think creatively, that allows us to think differently, that allows us to think constructively, and allows us to innovate? So I said I'd talk about the role of entrepreneurs. I think personally, for me, the experience of the last 7 months has led me back into the world of startups, because I think just doing it is what small business startups are all about. You know, we don't ask too many questions, we don't bother with too much research, because the best form of research is actually to get something out there and try it. And if it fails, do something else. And if it doesn't, do more of it. So this was actually, I stole this from Tracking the State of Innovation in the American Economy, a report released in January 2008. Entrepreneurial activity, particularly in startups, is critical to successful innovation. Every entrepreneur is party to innovation. Calculated risk-taking with a goal that is often only defined as let's win is the mindset of entrepreneurs. To make the economy more congenial to innovation is to construct an economic culture that appreciates what entrepreneurs do. I would argue that in this country at the moment, entrepreneurs are not well appreciated, and that the environment that we operate in is not one that creates the opportunity for entrepreneurs to grow and succeed. So measurement of innovation is complex and ephemeral, and there isn't never going to be one simple measure. But once again, I want to reiterate that it's got to be inputs and outputs. This is not supposed to be an exhaustive list of measurements. This is just to indicate the fact that there are output measures and input measures. And that what I see a lot of is reporting on input measures. It is about expenditure, for example, rather than outputs from that expenditure. We don't see very often organisations, or even at the broader economic level, reporting on things like sales of new-to-market products or sales of new-to-firm products. There's not much about that output that goes on. And I think because of the nature, because of the creative nature of innovation that we've all talked about this morning, that oftentimes those measures are going to be soft, and that's hard for us in a world where we're a business world, a world of academia, where we're taught to focus on hard measures. We want statistics, we want analysis, and sometimes it's actually fine to be okay with softer measures. And sometimes those softer measures are about really sitting down and throwing your arms, and I'm talking here figuratively rather than necessarily literally, around your customers and seeing how the innovation or potential innovation has impacted them. And I think I'm going to leave you with, I was looking at the booklet that you've all got in front of you. I love, by the way, how many innovators does it take to change a light bulb? Who's looked at the answer? I think that reinforces what we've heard from the previous speakers today. It is a team-based effort. I just want to pick out a sentence from the article in here, The Business of Brain Power. Brad Howarth wrote, "If Australians spent as much time practicing innovation as we did discussing it, we might well be one of the most innovative nations on earth." And I think that we have an opportunity as a country to be one of the most innovative nations on earth. What we've got to do is get on with the art of doing it rather than necessarily spending too much additional time talking about it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tim, for that insight. I'll now throw the discussion over to the floor. We have three very highly qualified panellists here to answer your every query in relation to innovation and actually doing it. So the microphone should be over on that side of the room. Please identify yourself with your name and organisation before you ask the question.
Hi, question for Tim. You're now an entrepreneur at large. When you were an entrepreneur not so large, where did you go to meet other entrepreneurs and to, you know, perhaps other forums or groups that you felt were really beneficial to achieving good outcomes for yourself?
I think that's a great question. Unfortunately, I'm not the best person to answer it because my answer is nowhere, really. And the reason for that is personal to me. I'm a sort of a bit of a lone wolf, and I tend to like to do things my way, and too much discussion means that I'm prevented from doing that. But there are a number of great forums in Australia. There's a number of state-based ones. So there's one in Sydney, which is Innovation Bay. There's the First Thursday Club in Sydney, for example. I'm sure there are others down here where entrepreneurs or would-be entrepreneurs get together and throw around ideas and discuss the things that are happening in a Chatham House rules environment. So probably a quick search, or maybe Ant Hill's website might have some of them, but a quick search on the web would quickly find for you some of them down here in Melbourne.
Hi, I'm Pippa. I'm from CSL Limited. Paul, you mentioned that Cochlear spends about 12% of your income on innovation. Could you just elaborate on what you would consider expenditure on innovation?
Yes, but I'll have to kill you, of course, if I tell you too much. That 12% is basically our what we consider our R&D group. A former boss of mine, a guy called David Money, who basically took the company from four people to about 300 people, had a philosophy. It was 15% back in those days, but we're hanging in there. He had a philosophy of 15% of the company's income would go to R&D, so looking after tomorrow's future. But that's something that any company like Cochlear will do. But he also then said, and 15% of that will go to what we now in Cochlear call enabling technologies. Back in my day, I was the 15% of the 15% at one time, and I was called Beyond 2000 group, because that was 1992, I think, when we did that. And then I still like to give 15% of the 15 of the 15, or 12 of the 12 of the 12, to just the odd wacky project that, you know, is will probably not make the company's future, but it will get people inspired and make them have a bit of a laugh and just think, wow, why are we doing that? So I don't know. I don't think we fund the art. I think we should fund Opera Australia or something and have a cochlear implant opera or, you know, something way out there. But just to get people thinking a bit. So we've always taken that attitude, and I've always, any budget that's come across my desk, I've always tried to take about that ratio and just, you know, do 85% what we're supposed to do and 15% what is maybe a little bit crazy.
David Pennington, University of Melbourne, and a former chairman of Cochlear when it became a public company. I'd just like to ask Tim to comment on what he thinks might the government be able to do that would help shift the culture in Australia to recognising the importance of trying things that might fail or might not, might succeed, but yet with incentives for people to take risk. Other countries in America, it's fully accepted that it's a career badge that you've had a company that failed and you went on to get another one. In Australia, that tends not to be the case. In Australia, we have our R&D relief and taxation, which is great, but that's fine for companies that have got profits. In fact, what we need is to be able to have people lose money in new ventures that then can count for 5-10 years against profits they might make, rather than it depend on whether they've invested in a listed company. It's the unlisted things that need to be backed and need to be developed. We've got to change that culture to get ideas right through into the marketplace in what's often a long process and a painful process. Any comments for people with government involvement?
Well, my comment, David, would be that I think you answered your question and answered it exactly the way that I would. I think there's two issues there. I mean, there's at least two issues. I'm a Gemini, so there's going to be two issues, I suppose. One is that I absolutely agree. There is not a culture that allows for failure in this country as there is in the US, for example. I mean, we're better than Germany, I guess. But, you know, Winston Churchill said, success consists of going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. But we have a culture in this country which, in fact, tries to destroy the enthusiasm at the tail end of failure rather than picking yourself up and belting on. So I'm actually not sure how, you know, a country changes a culture in relation to, or changes the attitude in relation to failure. But I think it is one of the things that is incredibly important. Seasoned entrepreneurs in the US are those that have failed a few times because that's how they've learned. Seasoned failed entrepreneurs in this country are down there getting the dole, you know, because they can't get a job. So that's one thing. I think there needs to be a response to that. But the second thing is, you're absolutely right. Tax relief is no good if you're not paying tax, if you're not making any money. And I think over the years, the amount of money that I've lost in businesses that can't be carried forward as some sort of tax relief is astronomical. And I think that looking at incentive programs through the eyes of a small business, which is, by the way, you know, a million of us in this country, rather than a large business is probably quite important.
I'll have a quick stab at that. Thanks for the question, David. I think, and it's been raised before in this meeting, I think the venture capital scene in this country is woeful and unrealistic. You know, so you basically have to have a proven product before you can get venture capital, which almost, you know, it's a catch-22. It defeats the object. It's much better than the US, for example. I think that would be an area where government could perhaps step in and provide support, perhaps
to help boost that industry and possibly even inject some capital into it. But I agree, you know, it's a bit of a cop-out from a government perspective to give tax relief when, you know, they're just they're taking less from us, if you like. Whereas, you know, look, it's not fair to not government. There are government grants, there's all sorts of schemes and so forth, but it could be a lot better, and I think that's one area where it could be targeted.
Yes, just a quick comment from the university perspective. I think one of the things, again, that we don't do is have much in the way of people in universities who then leave and go and start up companies. We focus on the links between industry and university so that there's some kind of transfer of knowledge into large companies. But that entrepreneurial culture means that we don't have the likes of Hewlett and Packard who leave Stanford University and create a small company which is the foundation of Silicon Valley and, you know, now a major multinational company. Not enough of that's happened here either, I think.
I think there was a question just... Was it there?
Yes, Ian Marsh from CEDA. I guess I've got a question for Paul. I was interested in your reasons for Cochlear staying in Australia. One, I think, was a multicultural society, and the other, we endure long air flights with relative calm. But there must be some others, and I'd be interested if you perhaps draw them out. And then, Tim, your position was really we're deficient in entrepreneurship, but I've always been intrigued by the numbers of people who registered under the Australian business number, the contractor kind of thing. I mean, it implies there's a huge number of people out there who are actually running their own business or regarding their lives as their own business. Isn't this a kind of, what's this piece of evidence tell us? Is this a base for moving forward into some other way?
Yeah, thanks. It's a really interesting question, and one that I've pondered a bit as well, in terms of why is Cochlear stayed in Australia. And the interesting thing about Cochlear is we had a role model of a company back in the 60s called Teletronics. It was a pacemaking company, and at one time Teletronics was about, I think, the third largest pacemaking company in the world. And pacemakers is a big business. It's a lot bigger than cochlear implants. So Tele was a massive company, and we've learned a few lessons from them along the way. Teletronics no longer exists. They went out of business mid-90s. One of the things they did wrong is they moved to the US. A lot of companies do it. Half their market was there, and I'm sure it was a well-justified business decision to move their office to the US. But one thing that happened, for example, they started acquiring other small U.S. companies. One of those U.S. companies that they acquired was a company called Cordis, which had a dangerous pacemaker, which ended up costing them more than the company was worth in class actions. So we've looked at Teletronics on a number of fronts and said, okay, they were a really successful company, but let's learn from some of the things that they did wrong. And one of them was to go gobbling up lots of other companies, and that was part of their move to the US because they based themselves in Miami where Cordis were based. And we have chosen not to do that. Another thing that we haven't done in our industry, and someone from CSL, I have a chat to them later, is taken the regulatory authorities head on. Regulatory authorities get it from all angles. If they put out another thalidomide, there's an outcry, rightly so. If they delay new drugs coming onto the market by making sure they're well tested and well proven, then they get it from the public because they're not putting out new drugs. So they're very, very defensive. Teletronics took the attitude, no, we don't have anything wrong with our company. We'll fight anything that you tell us we need to do. And we've taken the opposite. We've seen them as seen the regulatory authorities as unpaid, and they are unpaid because that's their charter normally, unpaid business advisors, because they come to your company and tell you what you should be doing better. So we are quite fortunate. I often think, actually, we had Tim was saying, we had an example of a company that went wrong, a very large company went wrong, and we've tried to learn, I think, in a number of areas, and moving to the US was one of them.
And in relation to your question about the
large number of ABNs being registered. I guess I see a distinction between, I'm talking about entrepreneurialism as an antidote to the problem of ineffective innovation, if you like. I think at the same time in Australia we have a very big culture of self-employment. So a lot of those ABNs are, self-employed plumbers and self-employed electricians, and self-employment's great. But I guess I'm thinking about it more in terms of a culture of innovation, and not all of those self-employed business people are going to drive innovation. Maybe to illustrate the point, about 18 months ago, was on a mission to get Telstra out of my life forever. I failed because they find ways to keep their hooks in one way or another. But nonetheless, I spent some period of months trying to eradicate them. And so I leapt straight from that camp into another one called Optus. And what I found was it was leaping from the frying pan into the fire. And I don't think either is better or worse. They're just the same. And it's that sameness that typifies this marketplace. Because we're such a small country, we have oligopolistic market structures. We have the four pillars of banking, which is a regulated oligopoly. And by the way, none of them are particularly concerned about anybody coming and cutting their grass, because there's never going to be anybody who comes and gets a banking license. So what happens in all those situations where we've got a small handful of large players dominating every single market space, Coles and Woolworths? Well, the customer gets lost in the mix. And I think it's up to entrepreneurs, if I go back to my telco example, Vodafone coming into the marketplace as a distant number three is not going to change the sameness of that offering. But somebody starting up a telco in, the garage of their home that says, we're not going to focus on price competition, which is what they do because they're all commoditized and they've got commodity products and offerings and they don't understand the customers anyway. What we're going to do is provide an exceptional level of service, for example. And we're going to make sure that our customers can call a real person any time of the night and day. And we're going to differentiate our offering based on that service proposition. Well, that's the role of entrepreneurs, is to disrupt sameness in marketplaces by being prepared to do something outrageous and different that big players, incumbent players, even if they come from offshore, are never going to be able to do. And so that's what I mean by encouraging entrepreneurialism. I think it's encouraging small players to be brave enough to disrupt the sameness in the marketplace.
Amanda Jones from Watermark. Look, it's been really great hearing the inspiration from the people on the panel. And I think a question to Paul. In terms of the growth of Cochlear, and you've talked about sort of 15 to 20% growth per annum, and you're now at a size of sort of 1,500 people. You talk about the energy, the culture, the fun. Does Cochlear see that there's a limit to the size that it can grow to maintain that creativity and just to be able to do the things that you're doing that have led to your success to now?
Oh, do we see there's a limit? Well, it was interesting. We had some sort of slides come down from the executive team a while ago in a strategic planning exercise. And, I suppose there is. Look, the short answer is yes, there is a limit. When we're bigger than Microsoft, I suppose we're probably going to hit some sort of roll off. But it's not worrying us at the moment. Let's put it that way. We've, as I say, there's evidence coming in now that we are, in terms of the ability of cochlear implants to serve our customers, we've gone from profound to severe. And even the moderate section is possibly, there are areas where we may make some inroads there. So let's have a change of paradigm even within the hearing industry. Our mission at the moment is implantable hearing. But then, we're partnering with Phonak, for example, which is one of the sort of high-end techie hearing aid companies based in Switzerland. And there are all sorts of interesting areas where
you know, joint hearing aid cochlear implant products can be imagined. And then the market is, you know, exponentially a factor of 10 bigger again when you start looking at those things. So, you know, I have to say that, you know, strategically, there's, you know, it's as an engineer, it's like Moore's Law. I don't know if, you know, those of you who are familiar with electrical engineering, you know, it's the amount of memory, you know, those things, those DRAM things that get stuck into your computer exponentially increase every, whatever it is, every 3 or 4 years. And the Moore's Law started in the 60s, and I was actually involved in my PhD in dynamic RAM. And you know, when they got it down from 6 transistors to 3 to 1, you know, that would seemingly be the end of the story. You know, then you can shrink that one transistor. So they did that. And then, you know, there are certain physical limits on how much you can do that. You think that's the end of the story. Then they went three-dimensionally. And it's these jumps that continually characterize, I think, good companies. And I can see 2 or 3 more in Cochlear's history, so I'm not looking in the Sydney Morning Herald for a job for a little while, hopefully, at least not for that reason, anyway.
We've got time for one more question.
Just a brief question for Tim. Tim, what do you say of the clustering theory, that you cluster together groups of smart people who will, and that will start to drive innovation, the Silicon Valley phenomenon, that sort of thing? Does that gel with your experience of what we need to do in Australia?
Yes and no. Look, I think it can be powerful. I think clustering can be powerful. You know, for anybody who's ever been to Silicon Valley, there is actually a vibe in Silicon Valley, even though, you know, it's an extended area. And you know, people in Silicon Valley know people in Silicon Valley, and people in Silicon Valley talk about people. So there is an energy there. And so I think clustering it can be important in terms of creating that energy. As long as it doesn't lead to groupthink, which is, once again, the antithesis of innovation. And it's actually, by the way, one of the other things I think about education. Too much education is a bad thing, in my view, because it can encourage the sameness of thinking and a one path. And I think potentially, you know, there is a risk of groupthink occurring anywhere where you put too many people together doing the same thing. I'd rather see, you know, 10 different approaches come out rather than one approach that everybody's talked about and ratified.
Yeah, look, I love going to California. I love opening the San Jose Mercury, is it? San Jose Times, and looking in their what's on column, and there will be on any given day there will be half a dozen First Tuesday clubs. I'm presuming that's the first Tuesday of the month. And there'll be in little wine bars and bookshops and things like that in Palo Alto, you know, based around the uni, Stanford and so forth. I agree fully with Tim. Innovation is sort of paradoxical in a way because, or systematic innovation, or, you know, my title is innovation manager. Well, as soon as you manage something, you systematize it and then it stops being innovation. So it's an interesting paradox. But nevertheless, I think we're actually we've a long way to go before Australia's in danger of that happening. You know, if here's a radical idea for Terry's review. Why doesn't the Australian government rent a block of flats? Now, that would cost most of the GDP in California. I know Australia's GDP in California, but nevertheless, a small block of flats in California where people are charged with going there and soaking up the atmosphere and going to the wine, you know, opening the San Jose Times and going there and just trotting along to these meetings for a month. And while we're at it, why don't we have a mixture of academics going to these flats and
university specialists, and people that we would want to mix with each other and share a pastor or two or whatever when they're back home anyway. Just a month to trot over there. It looks like a junket, and it is a junket, but that's one of the problems with innovation. Those innovation exercises that I run, I have to call them exercises because I can't justify just having a bit of fun for an afternoon. It would be a bit of fun, but there would also be a very serious purpose to it, and that is to soak up that atmosphere, just see what it's like over there and in Europe and so forth and in some of these clusters, and then come back to Australia. And while we're at it, mix people up who are there at the same time, and they might make some lasting friendships anyway. So I think innovation is a... What is it? It's not mine, but innovation is a contact sport, and it's not beyond the realms of possibility for the government to actually try and encourage that a bit as well.
Richard, do you want to add anything? One observation I'd have is in line with what Tim said, and I think the issue in Australia is just the small size of the place, and that you'll get, very, very small clusters, and I think that's when you get the groupthink phenomenon happening. But one thing we do here that can counteract that, and it's a feature of places like Silicon Valley as well, is being open internationally, and so having a throughput of people coming in here from different parts of the world with different sets of skills and providing some of that disruption so that we don't become complacent in some kind of, Melbourne innovation hub and main focus of our activity is being better than the Sydney innovation hub. That's a losing game for everybody.
Okay, well, on that note, I think we'll conclude. And I'd just like to thank Dr. Paul Carter, Dr. Richard Kearney and Tim Pethick for their very insightful comments and the answers.